cases on the oral argument calendar this morning, but there are four cases being submitted on the briefs without oral argument. And I will just note those for the record. The first case that's being submitted without oral argument is number 07-7131, Doolin versus the Department of Veterans Affairs. The second case is number 07-3135, White versus the Department of the Army. The third case is number 07-3214, Roberts versus Office of Personnel Management. And the third case is number is number 07-3262, Malik versus the Veterans Administration. Again, those cases are being submitted on the briefs without oral argument. The first case in which we'll hear oral argument this morning is number 07-1020, DeGusa Corporation versus the United States. And Mr. Stratford, you're representing the government, and I guess you have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I would like that, Your Honor.
Wanted to confirm that. You can start whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. This is a tariff classification case.
But I apologize. I said you could start. I'm going to ask you a question at the start because time is so fleeting here.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to jump on you so quickly, but in any event, as I read Judge Aquilino's opinion, okay, he seemed to agree with the government's argument in the CIT with respect to the reading of the note and so forth. He said this was your argument. He seemed to buy into your argument that these were impermissible impurities. However, he then, and I'm thinking in particular about the bottom of page 12, the top of page 13 of his argument, as I understand it, he seems to say, well, this is not relevant because you don't look to the surface of the crystal. You don't look to what's going on the surface of the crystal, you only look at the core of the bulk. That seemed to me to be the grounds on which he decided the way he did in the case. Okay? And indeed, DeGusa, in its brief, argues this point extensively, that the surface is irrelevant. They cite testimony of various experts and so forth. What is the government's response to that argument? Namely, that the surface is not relevant. Because you argue extensively about what result is compelled under the notes and so forth, but I didn't see you, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I didn't see you really address that point, namely the argument that the surface is irrelevant. Now I'll let you go from there.
Well, Your Honor, it's basic that anything that's imported is classified in the condition as imported. And here, we have a silicon dioxide that has been chemically aftertreated with the hydrocarbons and adding, in essence, impurities to the basic hydrophilic silicon dioxide. That makes the product hydrophobic and renders it particularly suitable for the
specific use. That's the argument that you made, and there's that interesting two-word sentence of Judge Aquilino's, where he says, I concur. But the point is, DeGusa would come back and say, well, you know, all of this goes on the surface,
right,
and that's not relevant. What is your answer to that point?
I believe, Your Honor, that in his opinion, where he says, well, we aren't going to consider the surface, the bulk in essence of this product is silicon dioxide, and it's 99.8% silicon dioxide. But he's only looking at the inside of this particle and not the entire product. Because as we point out in our blue brief,
aren't you saying, are you saying that the rules that govern in the chemistry classroom are not the same rules that govern in the customs house?
That's exactly
that really
right. Because in the classification.
If you look at the untreated, the goose has got two products, right?
The untreated and the chemically aftertreated.
Yeah, the untreated. Now,
right.
The untreated, right, product has got surface activity, right?
It has silanol groups on the surface.
Okay, so let's stop right there. You don't contend that that product should fall out of Chapter 28 because of that surface material, right?
It does not, because that's a permitted impurity within the meaning of Chapter Note 1A. And that's because...
Wait, just stop there for a second. An impurity has to be something that results from the manufacturing process, right?
Exactly.
Well, when the stuff that comes onto the surface of the pure SiO2 doesn't come on as a result of the manufacturing process.
Well, according to Judge Aquilino, it does.
Well, maybe Judge Aquilino may be wrong. You know as well as I do why the surface activity exists on the pure SiO2, right? It's just in nature. Make the stuff, and it's in a room, and there's some moisture, and all of a sudden you've got little dancing molecules on the surface. Right.
The it can add additional salinol groups, physically bond, but these are chemically bound.
The definition of an impurity is something that has to have resulted from the manufacturing process. And there are examples, right? You know as well as I do. There are examples, and they come because of unconverted starting materials, impurities, reagents, byproducts, etc. None of that is true with regard to the surface on the untreated material.
It's because on the untreated, the salinol groups are derived from the manufacturing process, as Judge Aquilino quite cogently pointed out. And if you look at the joint appendix, Your Honors, at page 710, you see the untreated silicon dioxide. And then the chemically aftertreated on the untreated, it shows surface groups of SiOH, which are the siloxane, the silanol groups, which is the impurities we're talking about. Those come from the manufacturing process, manufacturing the basic silicon dioxide, and then you add these methyl groups or the octyl groups. Which are the hydrocarbons.
In order to give the surface treatment in order to make the imported product that's in suit repel water, they throw a reagent of some sort on top of it, right?
It's the hydrocarbon groups.
And the hydrocarbon, it's not the hydrocarbon groups are formed as a result of a reagent being thrown on the chemical. Isn't that true?
They are formed, they are reagents.
They don't throw hydrocarbon molecules on top of it. They put some, isn't the reagent something else?
The reagent is the methyl groups and the octyl groups that react with the silicon dioxide, the silanol groups, and they replace
the silanol groups, so as in essence to eat up, to erode the majority of the silanol groups.
They replace somewhere between...
I understand that, but the point is that they simply erase the stuff that used to be water absorptive and then get rid of it, and consequently it's not that way in the final product. But the hydrocarbons are formed, right, as a result of throwing a reagent, if you will, on top of the chemical.
The hydrocarbon groups are introduced into the... they are a reagent themselves, and they interact with the silicon dioxide and form silanes, which is the methyl group, the CH3 group, attaches to the silicon atom and forms what's called a silane, which is the hydrocarbon group. In other of the products, as you see from the, again on page 710 of the appendix, the different surface groups that form, it's either methyl groups, the CH3, or the octyl, which is the CH17. And the hydrocarbon groups are there by covalent bonding to a silicon atom. Now,
the hydrocarbons are in the compound. They bond into the compound?
They are. They're covalently bonded, chemically bonded. So that's the reason why we say that is an impurity. And because it's deliberately left in the product to render it suitable for specific use, it's impermissible then. And therefore, it can't be in Chapter 28. On page 4 of our blue brief, Your Honor, we outline what it is that the hydrocarbon groups that are attached on the surface of the silicon dioxide do. And they, in essence, do 4 things. They prevent additional solanol groups from forming on the particle, and therefore maintains hydrophobicity. It neutralizes or blocks some of the solanol groups that remain on the surface. Since only 30 to 70% are replaced, there are additional solanol groups that remain there, and those are permissible impurities because they were formed in the initial manufacture of the silicon dioxide, and they aren't left in the silicon dioxide to make it suitable for specific use. They're just there. And that's true with these other compounds in chapter 28. You have solanol groups on those, but they aren't left in the product to make it suitable for specific use. And they come from the manufacturing process.
If the product in question, sir, had an impurity that was on the surface of the chemical, when you find it bonded to the surface, like the hydrocarbons bonded to the surface.
Yes.
So if there was a impurity in the product in suit that was permissible, then it would qualify for chapter 28, right?
If it didn't have the impermissible.
That you said simply, if it were permissible.
And in fact...
can you wait a second? So if that were true, then you would have something that at the core is SiO2, but there was something different chemical, if you will, on the surface. But that wouldn't disqualify, right?
It wouldn't disqualify.
What I'm trying to get you to understand is that the fundamental rule of the chemistry lab, which Aquilino thought caused the government to fail here, is a principle that I do believe is respected by the government. It's just that some impurity will fail if they have a particular, in application, have a particular effect on the product.
That's right, Your Honor. In making the silicon dioxide, you have some of the aluminum that comes off of the tubes. This is a de minimis amount, and that's considered a permissible impurity. And does not throw the product out of chapter 28 because it's not left in the product to render it suitable for specific use.
Is the definition of a separate chemically defined compound include permissible use, or is this a two-step analysis? Should we try and figure out first whether something is a separate chemically defined compound, and then if yes, does it have permissible or impermissible impurities?
I think probably, Your Honor, that's true.
So here's my question. So in the explanatory notes for the separate chemically defined compound, it says that the proportion of each element is constant and specific to each compound and is therefore said to be stoichiometric. So my understanding of the normal silicon dioxide molecule interacting with the environment is such that, you know, you have two little things on the end that wouldn't be bonded to anybody on the exterior. So would that meet the definition? I'm talking about the natural one, not the one that has been, you know, modified in this case, but would that be stoichiometric as this definition requires? A normal molecule, because interacting with the environment, it's not going to be constant throughout, right?
If you had the silicon dioxide and it has the solanol groups on it, that strictly would not be stoichiometric, and it would not be a separate chemically defined compound.
But then nothing would. Right? Because if we went with the idea that we took into account the surface in natural elements, then it seems like nothing could ever meet the definition of a separate chemically defined compound, because the molecule is always on the surface interacting with the environment such that it's not bonded the same way as it is in the interior.
Well, that doesn't apply to all of the... this chapter 28 includes elements and compounds, and not all elements and compounds have interaction with things outside the surface.
Some
do.
Some
do. The silicon dioxide does, and iron oxide. There are several of the things. The oxides, as Professor Canary our expert witness pointed out, there are a number of them that do like that, but those, the interaction then in solanol groups forming on the surface would be permissible impurities. It would not throw it outside of the.
I know it would be permissible impurity, but that's why I asked you if it was two separate part test. First, is it a separate chemically defined compound? Second, does it have permissible or impermissible impurities? And so I'm wondering, does it meet the first prong, a separate chemically defined compound? Because if we were to consider the surface in a natural molecule of this kind, not an altered one, then it seems to me that it wouldn't be stoichiometric. So it seems to me you have to exclude the surface of an unmodified version, or it could never meet the definition of a separate chemically defined compound, which can't be what was intended.
There are only certain compounds and elements that have an interaction with surface and present the problem that you have just pointed out, Your Honor.
So each of those silicone would never fall within the definition of a separate chemically defined compound? Is that what you're saying? You're saying it's not all elements.
I would say for silicon dioxide, since you do have solid groups on the surface, strictly speaking, it's not a separate chemically defined compound. It is not stoichiometric. The
Isn't
interior.
The reason why? Because customs respects the laws of chemistry.
The customs.
Why are you resisting me? I mean, the reason why the untreated product is a separately defined compound.
Containing permissible impurities, Your Honor. Not just that it's a separate chemically defined compound. The silanol groups on the untreated product have.
You better convince me that the silanol groups are formed as a result of the manufacturing process.
Well, Your Honor, that's exactly what the Degussa document here, the Plaintiff's Exhibit 19, on page A710, it shows that. This is not some silicon dioxide that's sitting around the warehouse and accumulates moisture, although it can. But in the manufacture of the silicon dioxide, it introduces some chemically bound groups, and that's the solanol group. And it shows it right here. And
which page is
it? Well, A710 of the joint appendix.
Show us how so.
Well, up in the upper left hand corner.
Upper left hand corner, right?
You see the SIOH there?
That's
a solanol group, and then this silicon dioxide is chemically after treated, and you wind up with this array here.
Is this box describing the manufacturing process or describing the chemical once it's in a product form? Can you answer that?
The way it's manufactured is a continuous manufacturing process, and you don't just manufacture, say, the untreated silicon dioxide and then throw that into a hopper and chemically treat it. It goes through one big process. And so I think it's reasonable to solely
and directly from the manufacturing process.
Right.
Mr. Stratford, I think you've used up your rebuttal and your rebuttal time, but you've had a number of questions from the panel. So we'll restore your full 5 minutes for rebuttal.
No, thank you very much.
And we'll hear from Degussa now. Mr. Van Arnen?
That's correct. Good morning, Your Honor. Please, the court. I'm Frederick Van Arnen for Degussa Corporation, and I'd like to focus my argument this morning on Mr. Stratford's position that the silane groups on the surface of a silica molecule, a silica particle, are impermissible impurities.
He says that the hydrocarbons that he says are added to the surface are the impermissible impurities, correct?
Yes, exactly.
And so that's the issue, whether that's an impermissible impurity.
Weren't you responding to this most recent discussion?
I'd like to respond to it two ways, if I may. I'd like to look at it from the legal analysis, and I'd like to approach it from factual analysis.
Why is it that the untreated products are properly categorized in Chapter 28?
Well, the untreated and the treated should both be in Chapter
28. I'm just talking about the untreated.
Because if you were a scientist and you analyzed what this product was, you determined that it was silicon dioxide. And the way you go about doing that
is... Why are the silanol groups that are on the untreated product, why are they not impurities?
Well, because again...
As defined in the note.
Well, they're not impurities because they're on the surface. And
they're good enough, forget about where they are. Are they the result of the manufacturing process?
No, they're the result.
Are they the result of manufacturing process?
No, they're not, Your Honor. They result by the laws of chemistry. Those valences have to fill. And that's what they do. They fill, and they fill by grabbing some of the existing water out there. But in order to measure whether something is an impurity, you have to ask yourself, what's it making less pure? And that's what this entire case is about, is whether or not...
No, but that's not the definition for what's an impurity. The definition for what's an impurity, impermissible impurity, is when such substances are deliberately left in the product with a view to rendering it particularly suitable for a specific use. That's not suggesting that it's an impurity in the kind that I would think of, something you want to get rid of.
Well, right?
I mean, this very definition permits the notion that an impurity of this kind could be something you'd actually like to have there because it is for a specific use. Just that's an impermissible impurity.
Well, Your Honor, if I may address your characterization of this as a definition, I think we're all starting from the wrong place here.
It says definition of impermissible impurity, chapter note 1A. This is not a definition.
Because it's an explanatory note. Now, let me explain, if I may, please. This is a tariff classification case, and it involves a two-prong analysis by reviewing court. The first analysis you do is you analyze the meaning of the relevant tariff terms. Now, the tariff term that is relevant here is Chapter 28, Note 1A. Now, Chapter 28, Note 1A provides, and I quote, separate chemical elements and separate chemically defined compounds, whether or not including impurities. Now, as a reviewing court, it's your responsibility to interpret the statute to give meaning to the legislative intent. And, of course, the first source for determining this legislative intent is the exact language that's at issue here.
So now, disregard the explanatory note because it's not legally binding on us.
Well, I'm going to get to that and explain not only that the fact that it's not legally...
Get to it now, if you don't mind.
Okay, this court, in Ruby's costume, stated that when you have... an explanatory note, which has a limiting language. You cannot use that limiting language to limit the scope of a tariff provision. And that's exactly what we have here. The statute talks in terms of impurities. It doesn't make the distinction between permissible or impermissible. It simply says, do you have an element? Do you have a compound? And if you do, it stays in Chapter 28, regardless of whether there are impurities on it. That's exactly...
Don't you think that possibly the reason that the explanatory note went about the process of distinguishing between permissible and impermissible impurities is because of exactly this kind of case, the kind of case where if you look at a molecule that's interacting with the environment, it's never going to be stoichiometric all the way across, never going to be, couldn't possibly be, right? Because it's interacting with the environment. Granted, apparently not all molecules do such things, but all silicon dioxide would. And so as a result, they adopted this permissible, impermissible impurity language to make it clear that when you've got a pure form of the element, it's not going to have the same stoichiometric representation along the outside. And so we'll call the fact that it's not the same all the way across a permissible impurity.
No, I don't believe that's what they intended. I believe they intended to look at the bulk of the particle and determine whether or not there are impurities within the bulk. And if there are, we're not going to take this product and put it in Chapter 28. I mean, to put it in Chapter, put it, we'll take it at 28 and put it in Chapter 38. I think it's important to understand that, in nature, matter falls into one of two general categories. You've got pure substances on one side, which consists of elements and compounds, and on the other side, you have mixtures. And not surprisingly, the tariff reflects it. Chapter 28 covers elements and mixtures. Chapter 38 covers mixtures. So clearly, the drafters of the tariff, by using this language, Chapter 28 includes products, separate chemically defined compounds, whether or not including impurities. Chapter 38 excludes compounds that can, whether or not containing impurities. Basically, what the drafters are saying here is you have to analyze the compound, determine whether or not it's a separate chemically defined compound. And if it is, and if there are impurities present, regardless of why they're there or where they are, it stays in Chapter 28. And as a matter of law, then it can't go in Chapter 38. And of course, this continues.
You're saying the notion that there could be something denominated an impermissible impurity is against the law.
I'm saying that it's certainly against the Ruby's costume decision. You cannot take limiting language. Now, why is this limiting language? Well, because the explanatory notes and the statute talk about impurities. Then the explanatory note goes further. Says, we're going to take this class of impurities and divide it into two discrete groups, permissible versus impermissible. And Congress didn't say that in the statute. Congress says impurities, doesn't distinguish between one and the other. So I respectfully submit that you need to give that explanatory note no weight. You cannot use that limiting language to narrow the scope of the law, the law that you're here to construe.
So let me ask you, if I could please, one question. You heard the discussion between Judge Clevenger and Mr. Stratford, in which the proposition was offered that, yes, as a matter of chemical science, when you're determining the structure of a particular compound, you simply look to the core, you don't look to the surface. That's reflected in expert testimony in the record. And then the thought was offered that, well, that's true, but here we're in a little bit different universe. We're in the tariff universe, and Congress has made a determination with respect to impurities and so forth. What is your response to that? Because that seemed to me to be a key point in Judge Aquilino's decision. He said, look, I'm going to ignore the surface. And I think the thought in the discussion that I referred to was that, yes, that's correct in a matter of chemical science, but it doesn't apply here. What is your response to that?
Well, I disagree with that, Your Honor. I think what Judge Aquilino did was he did a typical general rule of interpretation, one analysis. And he was faced with the statutory language, separate chemically defined compounds, whether or not including impurities. And he construed it, and he did so to reflect its common and commercial meaning. This is what judges do all the time when they're facing these tariff classification cases.
Well, and yeah, he said, I'm not gonna, he said basically the surface is irrelevant.
So he went and he
said, well, I'm just wondering, is my understanding correct? I think that's what he said,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Okay. I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay, now, why does that rule, which is correct, I suppose, in terms of what a chemist would say in analyzing a compound, why does that rule necessarily apply here when we're talking about a tariff classification where Congress can kind of set the rules?
Well, but Congress is presumed to know the rules of science and know the rules of commerce. And again, that's black letter customs law, that those rules are written into the tariff. And all that Judge Aquilino did here was he construed, I have to figure out what this product is. Is it a separate chemically defined compound? So he heard testimony. Every one of the witnesses, including the witness for the government, agreed that when we're going to determine whether something that is a separate chemically defined compound, we analyze the bulk of that particle. We do not care about what's occurring on the surface. So using this as the way to construe the language of the statute, the judge said, okay, let's hear testimony. And he did the second prong of his analysis where he determined that as a matter of fact the imported product fit within the scope of his definition of what a separate chemically defined compound
now,
is.
One of the provisions that's in Note 1A, the government sort of it cites it in its brief, but it's almost sort of a throwaway line, is this paragraph in Section 1A that says, and you can probably maybe address this, as products with added water repellents are, on the other hand, excluded since such agents modify the original characteristics of the products. Now, the government doesn't make much of that provision. It notes it in its brief, in the blue brief. Is that, what relevance, if any, does that have?
It has no application to this case. The government has tried to make some sort of fine line between hydrophilic material and hydrophobic material. But hydrophobic doesn't mean that it's a water repellent. That's a totally different thing. And if you look at the surface of the hydrophobic material, you're going to have hydrophilic qualities and hydrophobic qualities. It's not water repellent. It simply means something is hydrophobic.
But if it was one, you would agree that if it was water repellent, this provision would be pertinent.
Yes, exactly. If this was water repellent, then this provision would be pertinent. But it's not a water repellent.
No, it would help them.
Excuse me?
It would help them.
It would help the government, yeah. Yes. But it's not a water repellent. This the provision in Chapter 28 that's applicable is...
What is the purpose of treating the treatment of the product that's in the sea?
Well, Well, they treat the product so that they can create different grades of silicon dioxide. Right. Different customers have different applications.
Now, I mean, so, like, tell me what different application. Isn't it true that, that the product of soup is, if you will, unfriendly to water?
It's the product suit, yes, has an affinity towards oil and an aversion to water. But that doesn't mean that you can't put it in a water application. Nor does it mean that a hydrophilic product can't be put in an oil-based application. And there are all kinds of decisions
but
that
it might suggest that it's, quote, water repellent, close quote, wouldn't it?
But it's not water repellent, Your Honor.
In fact, at trial, an
example was shown where a quote-unquote hydrophobic product sank in water, and yet when they added oil to it, it gravitated to the oil phase. Because again, you have to view the hydrophobic hydrophilic in context of the liquid phase. The hydrophobics prefer oil. And so if you were using a reaction where you had an oil-based application, you perhaps would prefer hydrophobic. But let's say you're doing something where the liquid is a water base or alcohol or something else where there's the where the liquid is polar and there's an oxygen molecule in the middle. There you're going to prefer to have something that's hydrophilic. I just also want to point out that there was a period of time.
Isn't the use of silanes generally a way of rendering a product hydrophobic?
What the silanes do is simply go and they lop off one of those oxygen atoms. And
aren't they generally used for the purposes of rendering a product hydrophobic?
It's used to create products that have hydrophobic characteristics. But
so
again,
why doesn't that equal water repellent? I'm just having trouble.
But a hydrophobic product isn't water repellent. It's not like
what is water repellent then?
I think of something being water repellent that you know, it's a coating on a jacket that you pour water on and it beads off. That's not the situation here. If you have a mix,
that's the only thing that you think would qualify as a water repellent.
Off the top of my head, that's an example that I think of. But again, I would like to point out that if you have
your agent, your hydrophobes, they do modify the original characteristics of the product, don't they?
No, the product is silicon dioxide. They're not modifying the characteristics of the silicon dioxide. That silicon dioxide is still SiO2, it's a stoichiometric product, it's a compound.
Aren't your silanes coating the surface of the silicon dioxide?
No, they are not coating the surfaces of the silicon dioxide. They are simply bonding, they are lopping off.
What's the difference between coating and bonding?
I think of a coating as something that doesn't have a chemical bond to the surface. So for instance, if you took shellac and painted this, that would be a coating. And a coating would be a mixture because you'd be able to break it into its constituent groups. That's not what happens here.
Yeah, it doesn't say such products with added water repellent coatings. It just says added water repellent.
But again, this is not a water repellent.
But tell me again your case that stands for the proposition that the notion of an impermissible impurity is illegal.
Well, in the Ruby Costume decision, and it has to do with the application you should
use. Ruby what?
Ruby's Costume.
Is that cited in your file?
I'm not sure it is, but it's at 337 F3rd at 1359. In that case, the case was decided based on whether or not deference was accorded to the to some decisions made by customs, but then the court went on to say, in the event, here's a situation where there was limiting language and explanatory note, and we're not going to let the court use that limiting language to narrow the scope of the tariff provision. And again, I keep coming back to, what is the language that Congress used? What is its plain meaning? It is unqualified.
Are you suggesting that one of these explanatory notes is illegal?
I'm not saying it's illegal. I'm just saying that you should give it no weight.
I mean, if we apply the explanatory note, right, the way the government suggests, then you have these chemicals that have impurities. And the fact that they have impurities doesn't disqualify you from 28. So the untreated SiO2 has in it a permissible impurity. Only so it passes muster. Product in suit has an impermissible impurity. Seems to me that if the Chapter 28 note provision in 1A that the government's talking about is valid, then for my money, you've got a problem. You're telling me that because the definition of a separately chemical, that's a separately defined chemical, whether or not containing impurities, it has to, any impurity has to be permissible.
Well, Your Honor, that's how I read, that's how I read the language. Now, I have a hard time using the word illegal.
I mean, I'm a little sort of taken back by an argument that you make here, an oral argument based on one of our precedents that Note 1A is creates an unlawful category, i.e. impermissible impurity.
Well, we do say in our brief that the language of the statute is clear, that it includes all forms of impurities. Well, okay, let's drill down and let's look at impermissible versus permissible. I mean, you've already discussed the fact that it's not the byproduct of the manufacturing process. It's also not rendering the use a specific rather than a general use.
Right. These products... You haven't explained to me why the surface activity in the untreated SiO2 is not a result of the manufacturing process.
Well, because the silicon dioxide is already manufactured. The silicon dioxide is manufactured. It comes off the manufacturing process. At that point, those valences start to fill. All DeGusa does is it goes in and reacts to the silane.
They start to fill during the manufacturing process?
No, they start filling after the manufacturing process because that's how they fill in nature.
So the manufacturing process produces something that has these holes in it, if you will, right?
The manufacturing process produces silicon dioxide and has a byproduct of water and has a byproduct of hydrochloric acid. That's what you get when you mix silicon dioxide. At that point in time, those outer valences start filling. And in this case, they start...
They wouldn't fill if you hadn't engaged in a manufacturing process, would they?
Well, you wouldn't have silicon dioxide,
right?
Yeah.
Remind me again, I just want to make sure I understood your argument about the water repellents, right? Are you saying the use of silanes... I probably am saying that wrong again. Are you saying the use of silanes does not make chemicals water repellent?
The use of silanes in this case is not making the separate chemically defined compound water repellent.
In this case, I mean, is the use of silanes in other cases?
I'm not a chemist. I don't know how silanes are used in other cases, but I know in this situation, this product is not a water repellent. You could put this in a mixer with water.
Would it surprise you to know that DuPont, Dow Corning, Dynasylon, all of their websites have information on silanes that said they're used to make products water repellent, that that's their use is to make hydrophobic, and then they actually say, i.e. water repellent.
Well,
all these websites, all these chemical companies define the use of that product as making a water repellent. I realize it's not record evidence, but I was curious, but I don't know what silanes are. So
Your Honor, I'm focusing on what this product is. And this product, if you put this in water with a mixer that created enough shear, it would go into that water. And also, for years, there was no hydrophobic product.
So part of the problem is that the judge below disagreed with you. If you look at page 11 of the opinion where the government has trotted out its 1A argument, and the trial judge, they argue government argument here, the carbon-containing varieties are deliberately incorporated and left in with a view to rendering particularly suitable for specific use. This court concurred.
But then the judge also goes on to say, he doesn't say anywhere in there, there's no...
He concurs, and then he says, but that legal argument is insufficient because there are three categories of exclusion, and this particular product isn't one of the categories.
That's
correct. Let's assume that argument didn't carry the day. His next argument, Aquilino's reason for rejecting the 1A argument, the impermissible impurity argument, is to say, well, there's been testimony here that the bulk and essence of each of the powders are SiO2, separately chemicals. So he's saying, all you look at, you never have a surface.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that's how he construed the reference to separate chemicals.
Which brings us back to the question of whether or not the law in the chemistry classroom, never look at the surface, is the customs house bound by it.
Well, yes, absolutely, Your Honor, because again, the tariff is drafted, Congress is presumed to know the language of commerce and the language of science when it drafts the tariff. I mean, again, that's black letter law. I always cite the Niles case, Niles trading case in our brief to that point. But this again, this is how Congress drafts these tariff provisions. They're supposed to reflect what's going on in nature and what's going on in commerce.
Well,
But this isn't what's going on in nature. You've added something to the molecule.
But the point on this is that when scientists are presented with an inorganic material and are said, what is this? They analyze the bulk of that matter, and they don't concern themselves with the surface, because to determine whether something is a compound, they have to ascertain whether or not it's stoichiometric. And what's occurring at the surface, whether it's occurring naturally or occurring because of an additional exposure to a reactant, it's irrelevant for purposes of determining what it is that's before you. Now, this is silicon dioxide. There's an Ionami tariff provision in Chapter 28 for silicon dioxide. There's no reason to exclude this product from the scope of that Ionami provision.
Stephen Arnold, I think I've tried to keep an equal time here. I think in total, Mr. Stratford's going to have another 6 minutes, and I think that's about where you are. So I think we'll have to ask you to step aside.
Your clock isn't working here, by the way.
Right.
So there's no.
I know.
Okay.
That's unfortunately.
Obviously, I've been keeping an eye. You've had an additional 6 minutes, which is about the same as this.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Mr. Stratford said you have your full 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, John. Let me address first the water repellent question. On page 707 of the joint appendix, Producer states, all of the latter, the hydrophobic types of aerosol have an R in their nomenclature. The ones we're talking about here are R872, R, etc.
707?
And page
707. What are you talking about?
R? In 1.2.
The treated products is what you're talking about?
1.2.4. And that first paragraph of that sub-paragraph, it says, this letter R is taken from the word repellent.
Where's this now? Which?
Yeah,
this is on page 707 of the appendix.
Okay. At the end of the first paragraph under 1.2.4.
Right, and it says, don't confuse it with the registered trademark symbol.
Let me ask you, Mr. You note this point. You know that page 25 of your brief, this section of the note that refers to water repellents are excluded.
Yes.
But it did seem to me, I mean, it struck me that this was a point that you would have given, I guess, more prominent billing to. It was almost just sort of a, I'm not saying your argument is right or wrong, but I was surprised that you didn't give it more attention, because just on the surface of it, and Mr. Van Arnum has responded to it, on the surface of it, it seems to be a compelling point, but you didn't really argue it much in your brief. Why was that?
I believe it is significant, Your Honor. At the trial, we did not go into detail on that issue. We could have, but we didn't.
It's a kissing cousin to your 1A argument out of that chapter 28, isn't it?
That's from the explanatory notes from chapter 28, note 1, and the entire page at starting at page 259 of the explanatory notes, and on page 261 of the explanatory notes, the entire page is devoted to chapter note 1, and that's one of the such products with added water repellents are, on the other hand, excluded since such agents modify the original characteristics of the product.
Your adversary argues that the definition of a separate chemical says separate chemical whether or not containing impurities.
Right.
And there's nothing in that language that says containing permissible impurities, it just says impurities. So he argues that the note 1A upon which you rely is really not operative because of the
Rudy Hassel case. This is a product that contains.
What's your answer? Is leaving. He's saying that advisory note, so to speak, can't limit the scope of what the statutory command is.
Well, in fact, the judge devoted about two pages to citations for cases dealing with the fact that explanatory notes
are you familiar with the Rudy Hassel case?
Not in any great detail, Your Honor. I think it dealt with customs for whether they were clothing or whether they were other kind of articles.
Well, if we had a case, for example, that said it's against the law or an explanatory note to narrow the reach of the statutory category, wouldn't that imperil your case?
I would think that would be very surprising, Your Honor, because...
But if it were so, it would be... it would imperil your case.
Well...
would you say that the explanatory note maybe further defines the word impurities?
That's what it's doing here, because it's not defined in the statute, the term impurities, and the explanatory note is attempting to put some flesh on that.
Now, I realize that that's what's going on. You say, well, the agency ought to be entitled to have some definition. All I'm saying is that there were a case out there that said when Congress says separate chemical including impurities, and the Congress didn't decide that there was a distinction between permissible and impermissible, then you couldn't buy an explanatory note narrow, you'd be in trouble.
What Congress has done...
I have to believe that you're right, that the case isn't quite broad, because if that were so, this would have been... the case would have been over a long time.
Your Honor, if I could draw your attention to the chapter note, the rest of chapter note 1, for instance, chapter note 1D, this is a note and not an explanatory note. You can have an added stabilizer added, including anti-caking agent necessary for the preservation and transport. And 1E, you can have added anti-dusting agent added to the product to provided that the additions do not render the product particularly suitable for specific use rather than for general use. The explanatory notes for note 1 go into that in more detail and saying something like, well, you can add oil to the chemical so it doesn't let out poisonous fumes.
Stratford, I think your time is... I've tried to keep people. I think you've had maybe a teeny bit more than Mr. Van Arnen, but I think it's basically been about the same. So we'll have to bring things to a close.
Your
case is submitted.
Your Honor, can I point out one